This podcast is sponsored by Canaccord Genuity Wealth Management, award-winning wealth managers who go above and beyond to support and guide you. Visit candowealth.com to start building your wealth with confidence.
Hello and welcome to Coffee House Shots, the Spectator's daily politics podcast. I'm Cindy Yu and I'm joined by Katie Bors and James Forsyth. So today, Michael Gove, the Chancellor for the Duchy of Lancaster, is going to Israel to check out what's going on there with the vaccine passports. Katie, what's the purpose of this trip?
Officially, it's a fact-finding mission, also known as a listening exercise. But I think the phrase listening exercise is met by increasing cynicism in the Tory party. You've had Michael Gove inviting lots of Tory MPs to listening exercises on vaccine passports. And this trip to Israel, which is also seen as a listening exercise to some degree. Again, there's a strong steer and push that ultimately no final decision has been taken on vaccine passports. But just as MPs who go to listening exercise with Michael Gove believe a decision has been taken, I think Michael Gove's decision to fly out to Israel and meet with various Israeli politicians and look at various things, including the Green Pass system, is just seen as a further confirmation that we are heading to some form of COVID vaccine identification system. Now, again, they'll say no decision has been taken, but I do think it just feeds into that narrative. We also know that work is underway in terms of developing an app, what that would look like. Gove said that to MP. I think documents have now appeared on that. So I think if that's the starting point, ultimately looking at how the various policies work in Israel and what the UK can learn from that. Now, we know that when it comes to a model that the UK would like to replicate, Israel is top of the list. If you look at how, you know, the infection rate has fallen, deaths have fallen, cases have fallen, I think that's where the UK would quite like to get to. But I think there are questions about how easy it is to replicate a system in Israel, which is a country which is clearly very used to having, impositions on security to a country like this.
But James, isn't the point about Israel's vaccine passports is that they're not really being used by people, by many, many premises? And we had a piece recently in the magazine by Anshul Pfeffer, the Israeli journalist who wrote a biography of Benjamin Netanyahu, that people there are just not really looking at them.
Celia, I think you're right. I think you had vaccine passports, I suspect you would have a similar response here that you've had in Israel, where there are certain restaurants which check them with great detail. There are other places that don't do that much. One of the reasons I've always thought this about vaccine passports, you know, part of the attraction is about an incentivizing people to, which is undoubtedly one of the reasons the Israelis went down this route, incentivizing people to get vaccinated, especially younger people who aren't at that much personal risk from COVID. But in the pursuit of herd immunity, you want to urge them to get vaccinated. I mean, it's quite interesting. There's a very good story today in the New York Times about the US's struggle, how it is now encountering vaccine hesitancy. Obviously, the Biden administration, although this is in most cases a decision for the states, has ruled out kind of vaccine passports very emphatically. It hadn't even incentivized people to get the vaccine. I think the second point which the UK government is, lots of people in the UK government who advocate vaccine passports would argue that their real value might come later in the year. So if you've got an autumn resurgence, for example, of COVID, vaccine passports might be allow you to keep mass events going, they argue, in those circumstances. Although there is, I think, an interesting question here, which is currently the UK's vaccine take-up is so high. And if that were to carry on, the value of vaccine passports, I think, would begin to diminish. Because, you know, if you're in a situation where 95% of the population have taken the vaccine, the benefit of the vaccine passport system is less.
And Katie, in other news, Johnny Mercer, the Tory MP who was a defence minister until yesterday, has left the government in pretty sudden circumstances. Can you explain what happened?
Sudden in a way, but also painfully drawn out over the course of a day. Yesterday, when we had reports emerging, I think Sam Coates from Sky initially saying that colleagues have been told Johnny Mercer is planning to resign. Now, I think as soon as this came out, planning to resign it's not a place anyone really wants to be in such a public setting. It almost becomes inevitable that you have to go unless there's some special reason behind the scenes that this is resolved, or perhaps your scene is so important to the entire government that everyone's going to make this effort so you don't. But generally, it's not a sign of health. And then as the day went on, more leaks about why Johnny Mercer was unhappy, who he'd said he was unhappy to. And I think by the end of the day, ultimately, it got to such a point of farce that Johnny Mercer was invited to a meeting with the Chief Whip, which is ultimately, you know, what are you doing here? Are you staying? Are you going? Are we going to have a live blog all about what you're thinking about your career? And I think we're calling it resigned officially. I think some would say at this point pushed. And I think perhaps a difficult meeting. Now, why has Johnny Mercer resigned? It relates to veterans, is his thinking on this, and the fact that he did not feel that he was fulfilling promises he'd made in respect to veterans, with various legislation coming through the House. But also, I think if you speak to Tory MPs, there was a sign that this was perhaps an inevitable situation. There was a case of, you know, not if but when. I think that he's seen as an absolutist on these issues, and therefore when it comes to finding a resolution, I think people thought it was hard to ultimately do that if you're not willing to move some way. Now, clearly Johnny Mercer's reply to this is that you shouldn't move because, you know, courage of your convictions. But I don't think it was met with huge surprise that he has left the role. And also, I don't think all colleagues are so sad to see him leave that position.
James, as Katie mentioned, the argument with the government was over veterans and the treatment of veterans. Can you explain a little bit more about what the differences in opinion are? And, you know, has the government found someone a little bit more cooperative on that to replace that role now?
I think he feels that veterans have been let down, per se, across the piece. But I think his particular beef is about people who served in Northern Ireland. I think his argument is that the overseas operations bill, which is going through Parliament, you know, doesn't help veterans of the Northern Ireland conflict, and that he wants specific legislation to deal with them. I think this is a very complicated question. I personally would slightly disagree with the Mercer position in two ways. I think a kind of statute of limitations on offences and the like risks creating an equivalence. You know, people say, oh, it's unfair that IRA terrorists are allowed to go free because of the peace process while British soldiers in their 70s or 80s are investigated. I personally hold British soldiers to a far higher standard, and we should be proud to hold them to a higher standard. We're a country committed to the rule of law. You also can't get over the fact that these troops are not operating in a foreign country. They were operating on British territory. And I think this is where it gets very difficult, which is if you are going to have some statute of limitations or amnesty, you are essentially treating them in a kind of peace process way, in the way that you've treated IRA terrorists or lawless paramilitaries. I don't think that is appropriate for British troops. I think there are sophisticated ways around it, about that you could not allow an investigation to begin unless a senior legal authority had considered, for example, that there was reasonable new grounds for embarking on this investigation. But I think this is, it's not just the politics of Northern Ireland and legacy issues here that is complicated. It is the fact that this is British soil, and the upholding of the rule of law is, I mean, absolutely paramount. And I think that you cannot accept anything that tries to lump British soldiers into a kind of process akin to that has been extended to terrorists in that conflict.
And Katie, the government has seen other personnel changes overnight as well, with the departure of Allegra Stratton from the role of Press Secretary. Can you explain what's been going on there?
Yes, so the much-hyped Number 10 press briefings that have been discussed, I think, on this podcast several times, are no longer going to happen. Now, there were going to be televised lobby briefings, and this was the brainchild of Lee Kane. Side note, he has a piece in the magazine this week, not on this topic, but his first piece
since
leaving the
role. But about his experience in government.
Yes, exactly. But it was his brainchild, and it was looking to the US system and seeing what you could bring here on that. Now, he left the role late last year, and partly over disagreements over who would take on the role. Allegra Stratton had the role, and I think that there became an issue in the sense that there was lots of concern over really whether the televised briefings were such a good idea going forward. I think that increasingly in government there is a sense there could be more trouble than ultimately their worth. And this decision, I think, was something that's been like mooted for some time, but has now been confirmed. Now Stratton is moving to a COP26 role as a spokesperson. But I think in terms of the general government comms strategy, it just means that I think we're seeing a slight shift away from when Boris Johnson first became Prime Minister in that Tory leadership campaign. It was much more confrontational. I think ministers boycotting certain shows. And I think these televised briefings were seen as a way to have coverage on your terms, or at least dictate the terms. But I think we have seen a shift in that. It's now a less combative tone to the comms. And as part of that, I think ultimately a decision has been made that they are not worth the risk. And we've seen how difficult questions in these press conferences with the Prime Minister, there's one yesterday on Jennifer Curie. I think there are lobby briefings on things like that, which showed how on a quiet day or just on a day when there's bad news, these things can really get to a point where they're very uncomfortable for the government. And therefore the format is seen as particularly risky, which I think explains why we're now in this place. Though there is a question, of course, about the fact that millions have been spent doing up number 9 Downing Street in terms of the studio. Now, we've been told that there'll be lots of press conferences there, but I think when it comes to taxpayers' money, there'll be questions about, given they are not going ahead, was that such a good use?
I wish we had millions to spend on the Spectators podcast suite.
I mean, these microphones are vintage at this point, which is almost fashionable.
Listeners are treated to sirens coming by because of the lack of double glazing.
We should ask to borrow it.
And coming on the tail of that expenditure, James, and on the tail of the Green Seal scandal, today it's transpired that James Dyson, the entrepreneur, has been texting the Prime Minister, Boris Johnson, one-to-one. What's been happening there?
So this dates back to the ventilator challenge. There was, if you remember, if you think back to about this time last year, there was a kind of theory that the big thing that was needed was ventilators, that was going to help you against COVID. It later turned out that intubating people too early could be deeply unhelpful, and so ventilators have not turned out to be as important as well. But the government launched this thing called the Ventilator Challenge, an attempt to get companies that don't normally make ventilators start making ventilators, because obviously ventilators from all around the world were being brought up, and the government wanted James Dyson to take part in this. James Dyson's firm is now headquartered in Asia, not here. And essentially, what Dyson was seeking in these text messages with Boris Johnson was an assurance that if Dyson employees came here to work on the project, they weren't suddenly going to find themselves subject to UK tax, that have their tax status changing. Now, I think these messages, Labour obviously reacted this morning like this was a kind of smoking gun of Tory cronyism, you know. But I don't think they have had quite, and PMQs, Boris Johnson, was quite happy to defend his actions, I think, on the grounds that, you know, this was an emergency, ventilators were needed. And in the Commons, there was a kind of political consensus on waiving some of these tax rules to try and to for people helping out with the COVID crisis at that point. I think the awkward question is about the fact that all these conversations are happening on mobile phones. Boris Johnson says that, you know, he informed his officials of these contacts as soon as they took place. And I thought the most effective bit of Keir Starmer's attack today was this, was his argument, you know, what about the people who don't have your personal mobile number, Boris Johnson? You know, that is obviously slightly tricky. And then I think there's also this question of, you know, it sounds like from Laura Koonsberg's reporting today that Dyson people arguing the Treasury were then quoting these texts back to Treasury officials to try and say, well, look, the Prime Minister told us this was going to get sorted. But I personally think that these attacks work for some sense of self-interest, right? That Boris Johnson was somehow personally benefiting from this. It was clear that Boris Johnson was trying to do everything he could to get an engineering firm to come here and build ventilators and was prepared to kind of offer them assistance to do that. So I don't think this is quite as devastating an attack as Labour think it is. But, you know, I think that obviously Labour have made a strategic decision that one of their most potent weapons at the moment is this allegations of cronyism around PPE contracts and the like. And that they will try and use that to kind of drive, to basically try and say to the voters, you thought the Tories don't share your values, look at the way they behave. And I think this is in a way Labour are doing this attack because none of their other political attacks are landing, but that doesn't mean that it isn't without danger to the Tory side.
And James, how is it possible that we know the contents of these texts, because we seem to know it verbatim?
Yeah, so I think there have been a kind of series of Boris Johnson messages that have popped up in the press in recent months. I think this one is a slightly different story because Laura Koonsberg of the BBC is reporting that these texts were then referenced by the firm, Dyson, the company, when it was having correspondence with the Treasury about this issue. So that, to my mind, seems to me the most likely explanation for how this has come out, I think, is that Dyson, not the person, but the company, were writing to Treasury saying, here's what was said between James Dyson and Boris Johnson. Please, can we fix this issue? And so I don't think it's a, I don't think someone's kind of hacked the Prime Minister's phone or anything like that.
James, some people might be wondering whether or not this harks back to earlier reports of a Labour mole within Conservative ranks.
I think there's a danger that kind of talk can sound slightly paranoid. I think what is more likely is that officials, in seeing these texts referenced in correspondence, that certainly would be unusual, and that the thing has leaked from there.
James and Katie, thanks very much, and thank you very much for listening. If you like this podcast, do you rate and review us, and why don't you recommend us to a friend? Thanks for listening, and join us again tomorrow.